Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Kurdistan Connection here on Media News with myself, Matt Broomfield. As listeners will know, on this show we try to put political events in Kurdistan in their wider global and political context and look at how they relate to what's happening in international affairs in the region, in Europe and in America. Our subject today is a really important one that often on this show we talk, I think, particularly about the situation in Rojava and Syrian Kurdistan, and we talk about Turkey a lot as well. And this is an issue, I think, with a lot of coverage of what's happening in Kurdistan. But this week brings a very important anniversary, as many listeners will be aware of the uprisings that began on 16 September of 2022 with the killing of Jina or Mahsa Amini, a Kurdish woman living in Iran who was killed, beaten by the morality police there for perceived infractions over her wearing of the headscarf. And this began a protest movement that some people have characterized as a women's revolution, which spread throughout Rojhelat or Iranian Kurdistan, which spread throughout Iran, and which was seen and heard and recognized all over the world. But it's been a year now. A lot of attention has turned elsewhere, but of course, Iranian Kurdistan hasn't gone anywhere. Those women haven't gone anywhere. Their demands haven't gone anywhere. And the situation right now in Iran and in Iranian Kurdistan remains tense and is really worth us coming back to and taking a close look at now. And so for that reason, I'm really happy to welcome our guest for today, Rojin Mukrian. Rojin, you're welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
I was very happy that Rojin agreed to join us today. I thought she would really be the perfect person for putting what's happening in Iran in context. Rojin is a member of the Diplomatic Committee of the Kurdistan Freelati, or PJAK, and an academic. So she in Ireland. And so she really, I think, is well placed to go a bit under the lid of what's happening in Iran and in Rojhelat and explain, you know, sort of away from the headlines, away from the slogans, what's kind of really happening, what hasn't changed. So yeah, Rojin, I guess my first question is simply this. It's been 1 year since those protests began. What has and hasn't changed in Iran and in Rojhelat?
Okay, it's a very good question. What has changed and what hasn't? Basically, I would like to start by saying that for many of us, a revolutionary movement under the banner of Xinjiang Azadi has started after the brutal murder of Jina Amini, who was killed by the so-called morality police on 16 September 2022. During the burial of Jina Amini, a Kurdish woman, a very young Kurdish woman in the cemetery of Ayçiçek in Sakız, the hometown of Jina, she throwing off her headscarf and chants Xinjiang Azadi. And all the people that were kind of marching in the cemetery embraced this movement, this move by this young woman, and the woman that they were present in the cemetery, they also threw their headscarves and chanted Xinjiang Azadi. This slogan soon and very fast moves to Sanandaj, and in the university in Sanandaj, everybody chants Xinjiang Azadi, and the slogan again so fast goes to Tehran University. So we see here that Xinjiang Azadi, this slogan that basically emerges from the idea of Abdullah Öcalan, could break all the artificial boundaries and divisions that the nation state system created for us, divisions such as divisions based on nationality, ethnicity, language, religion. So Xinjiang Azadi, it could really unify all the people across Iran and to organize a revolutionary movement. But to understand what this revolutionary movement was and is and what did to the society of Iran and what was its effect, what has changed or not, we should understand that when we're talking about a revolutionary movement, we refer to a social movement, a bottom-up movement, that strives or seeks to bring fundamental change within the existing system, within all the spheres of life, like to change the mentality, to change the culture, society, economic, and at the end, of course, politics. So it is a bottom-up movement, and the change actually starts from the society. The change actually starts by changing the mindset of the society. With the mindset of society is basically the culture. So a lot has changed in this term. Like we see that the many men now shoulder by shoulder of women, a man that they like live in a very patriarchal society, have very patriarchal mindset, now shoulder by shoulder of women, they're standing and chanting Junjian Azadi, woman life freedom. So they're not opposed to the idea at all, opposed to the idea of woman liberation, but they actually promote the idea. So I say in this sense, a lot has changed. A lot of bottom-up change has started, and we see every day that it shapes the society in different ways. Again, for example, it creates a very revolutionary culture among the people. For example, we see now basically the burial or funeral ceremonies turn to a very political, like turn to an area for political demonstration. Like we see the mother of the martyrs who were killed by the Iranian regime, they don't really mourn their kids as a like a passive victim anymore, but they chant Shahid Namre, martyr never dies. And this actually cultural revolutionary didn't stay only in Rosh Halat, and it moved beyond Rosh Halat. And we saw it in even like other Persian like cities that the mothers do the same. And during this funeral ceremonies, we see even the family members of all the other martyrs that they come and they basically, based on their shared experience of oppression and the feeling that they have, they, I would say, they organize a form of kind of transnational solidarity that is unique. And it is one of the most important factor in this revolutionary movement so far. It is that transnational solidarity. And the change, basically, so far, it is all in cultural setup. Yeah.
And when we speak about these forms of change, you know, this new sense of solidarity between peoples, this new, you know, men standing next to women, how organized are these changes? Is this just a feeling among the people, or are there organizations, are there leaders, is there a plan for what's happening?
Well, it was a grassroots kind of movement. There wasn't any leader inside the Iran or Rosh Halat to say to kind of formally organize this movement. But if we refer back to all the videos and the evidence that we have from September, especially to January, it demonstrates one fact. There were a very nice rhythm or structure within the protests. For example, we saw for the first few months, every Saturday there was a public strike. And we saw that the protesters, like basically they were not gathering in the same place, in one city. But for example, if we talk about Rosh Halat, a city, for example, like Mahabad, we had few different gathering in the same like day and at the same time. Each people in their own neighbor, they were gathering in the evening, they were occupying the street, and they basically forming a fortress resistance on the streets. So we saw some sort of organization, informal way of organization, or basically, I don't know how to really we can call it, because we don't have access to many information inside of Iran, but there were like some sort of structure within the protest, and there were some like very kind of nice rhythm within the movement and had its own momentum, I would say.
And so now it's been a year, as you said, maybe by January of this year, the level of the protest started to go down. There was, of course, like a lot of repression, many hundreds of people at least died. Are there any possibilities or perspectives for turning this energy and this anger into bigger social change in Iran, and how?
I think I need to talk about something that a lot of change happened in terms of the culture and the especially revolutionary culture and the mindset of the society, but the Iranian regime still is in power, is still there, and the Iranian regime hasn't changed. And especially the stance of Iranian regime toward the people, especially the women, not only hasn't changed, but it tries to even like intensify its anti-woman policies. So Iran is there, but if the streets are empty, does it mean that revolutionary movement came to end? If we go back to the definition of the revolutionary movement, which is a bottom up and a very gradual change, and the changes start from the bottom, from the society, I would say this revolutionary movement hasn't changed. And in many aspects, every day it's updating itself, it's spreading across all regions inside Iran. But you're right, the streets are calm at the moment. The people are not outside the streets. And I think they were like, the people have their own reason for this, that why they went back inside. Maybe in the next question, I will come back to this. But to bring the people again to the streets, we need for some sort of leadership, maybe a council of leadership to organize the protest, especially from the outside. Because I don't mean to monopolize, I just want to refer to a council of leadership that basically reflect the voice of the people inside. But since the Iranian regime really responds to the protests with brutally, the people don't have inside Iran, the people don't have this opportunity to really openly organize themselves or to make their own organization or any other form of like forming like especially transnational organization that brings the people together openly. But outside, the people outside have this opportunity to do this. And one reason actually that people went back inside and they left the streets inside Iran was the rule of opposition here. The Iranian opposition really acted so weak, and they had very detrimental impact on this revolutionary movement so far. So to bring the people outside again, I would say, yeah, the role of the opposition is very important.
And as you've said, the opposition, of course, the Kurdish opposition, particularly in Iran, faces a lot of challenges, and maybe other parts of the opposition haven't played like a strong role in leading these protests. I know on the anniversary, there's been a call for a general strike and for protests by many of the Iranian Kurdish parties. What do you think, what steps are necessary for the opposition to play a more prominent and effective role? What could they be doing that isn't happening now?
Okay, I would like to make a distinction between different oppositions at the beginning, because I would say so far we can distinguish two different oppositions. One is the far-right opposition, Iranian opposition, that Reza Pahlavi is basically leading it. And we have another opposition that hasn't formed yet, but we are hoping that this one can form, and we can call it the left democratic and libertarian opposition. And for this, I would say that the precondition to form this coalition, it is the coalition between the Kurdish political parties in the first place. So why the coalition between the Kurdish political parties is so important? I'm talking about the Kurdish political parties in Rojava or Eastern Kurdistan or Northwest Iran. Because in Iran, inside the Iran, we know that this revolutionary movement has started inside Kurdistan, and the Kurdish people actually were in the center of this revolutionary movement. And it was the Kurdish people that were leading actually this movement. And we saw in other parts of like Iran, for example, Tehran, they were actually listening and to what Kurdish people are doing inside. And they were saying that if like Iran becomes like Kurdistan, all Iran could turn to a heaven. And they inspired by the Kurdish people inside Iran. But outside the Kurdish political parties, especially in the beginning of this movement, they were so, they had very different and diverse approaches to how deal with this movement. They had very different perspective regarding what kind of government or governance the Rojhelat in the future should take. So, and we shouldn't forget also, today, we understand politics in its realistic kind of term. And for Kurdish political parties, for most of them, politics is struggle for power. And all this created obstacle for the Kurdish political parties to come together and to make a coalition. And in 2018, Pejak actually proposed a 10-point statement, and it was a proposal to bring the Kurdish political parties together. And based on that 10-point like statement, it was asking the Kurdish political parties to send their representative, and also academies, feminists can send their representative, civil activists can send their representative, and if we could form this coalition among the Kurdish people, later we could extend this coalition to other parts of Iran. For example, we know that 8 different nationalities live in the political geography of Iran, and we could transfer that and make coalition with the oppressed nation in Iran, but we couldn't so far. And another obstacle for this is again the Persian leftists, because so far, the Kurdish people and the Persian leftists have different understanding of national minority issue. The Persian leftists still consider all the problem inside Iran through a Marxist kind of lens, and they reduce everything to economic problems, and they think if we solve the class problem and if we remove capitalism, we can solve the national problem. And many of the leftists still, they don't believe in national minority issue. Like they refer to still the Kurdish nation as a just ethnicity, or they still, so we have so many problems. But fortunately, now, a few days ago, we saw a joint statement by 6 Kurdish political parties, which is, I would say, very important step to make a very practical steps toward creating a coalition or a political platform for the Rojhelati Kurdish, Rojhelati people. So that was,
you mentioned this small kind of coalition that perhaps is being established among some Kurdish parties. Do you think, is there then the idea that they might be able to reach out to other minority groups, to women's groups, to even the like Marxist Iranian left, and try and expand this further? Is this a possibility?
Well, it was early June that we had one conference in the European Parliament, and it was composed of all, most of the representative of most of the national minorities of Iran and many Persian leftists. And in that conference, I would say I realized that there is, again, very shared kind of understanding of what the issue is. For example, we all felt the oppression that we all have, and we felt this, and this kind of feeling the same oppression that we are facing every day in our life, I would say maybe have the potential to bring all these national minorities together. But I'm optimistic, but at the same time, I would like to be realistic as well, and we see the challenges. For example, Turkish Azeri, sometimes we see that Turkey tries to move here and to diverge any kind of, convergence that we want to build. Turkey tries to put an obstacle on that. But we are optimistic, and there are more conferences that compose of all representative of national minorities. At least we basically so far have the same understanding of the problem. And I think to understand the problem and to accept what is the problem can help us to reach one solution too.
And so, yeah, as you mentioned a while ago, the international community, maybe particularly America, often kind of takes as the Iranian opposition, perhaps the even the kind of Pahlavi monarchy, or people who want to see a return to the situation in Iran prior to the revolution, when of course things were far from perfect, or perhaps at most more liberal reform-minded individual campaigners. Do you think the United States or other international forces could or should be doing more to support these other opposition groups and this, what you call the more kind of social and progressive opposition than it is at the moment?
I would say either if the United States to support this far-right opposition or not, they don't have basically any social status inside the Iran. And what the people inside Iran actually is seeking is completely opposed to what the U.S. or Reza Pahlavi want to impose on them. Again, let's to refer back to the slogans that were coming from the inside of Iran. And one of the slogans was that, like, death to oppression, oppressor, it doesn't matter if it's a Shah, king, or a leader, referring to the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. And we were hearing that from different parts of Iran, not just from Kurdistan, not just from Balochistan, from different parts of Iran. And we shouldn't also forget that many of these people that they were in the forefront of these protests inside Iran, they were young women, young people, they were the university students, they were the high school students, and these high school students and these the university students, I think they reach a very political conscious that they don't just seek regime change, or they don't want to transfer power from one segment of the society to other segment of the society. They want to bring a fundamental change. They want to seek basically shelter in the shadow of this system. They tried reform in Iran many years ago, and it failed. In 2019, the protesters very loudly told Iran that they don't want reform anymore. And again, one of the slogans of this movement, what was it? That it doesn't matter you are a hardliner or reformist. That's it. We're done with you. And so if we refer to this idea, I would say that it doesn't matter how much US or somebody like Reza Pahlavi tries to impose himself as a leader to this movement, he cannot achieve anything, because it's not the people of 1979 that they are in the street. It's not the people of even 1925 when the Reza Khan took control of Iran. We are dealing with very consciously young generation. And we shouldn't forget that the middle age for the Iranian society is below 30 years old. And we shouldn't forget also that 60% of the university students are women. We shouldn't also forget that 70% of the students in high school are also women. And these women are fighting against the patriarchy that it is institutionalized both in the state and in the society. So I would say that there is no return for the society. And actually this society find their own exit of this existing system. And every day through these changes that I already mentioned them, they try to empower themselves. And once they reach a balance of power, they can easily bury the dead body of the Islamic Republic. Because we shouldn't forget, the Islamic Republic is completely dead for the people inside, has no legitimacy for the people. And it's the people basically completely separated themselves from the state. And we are dealing with two different separate entities inside Iran, the people and the state. So these two are in direct conflict now together. And so it doesn't matter how hard they try. I would say they want success.
Thank you very much, Regine, for sharing it with us. And I think, yeah, particularly this reminding this is not only a women's revolution, it's a young women's revolution. Yeah, I think illuminates a lot the need for new ideas, the new perspectives. And it was really good today to hear not only the challenges faced and the setbacks that have come even following these uprisings, but also that there are some new things are happening, new conversations are taking place, and there is this wider spirit for change as well. And I'm sure it's a long road ahead, but we will certainly keep following the situation there, following this anniversary and following your work as well. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us today and share your perspective. It's been invaluable. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much for giving me this time. Thank you.
Thank you. This has been the Kurdistan Connection with myself, Matt Broomfield, and Rojin Mukrian. Until the next episode, goodbye.